Welcome everyone to our session. I realize this is like the end of like a long week, so I'm honored that anybody is here. So thank you so much for coming. And we do have a cool Xbox to give away. And the great news is with the number of people in the room, your percentage is actually pretty good of winning. So this might be a great way to end the show. So my name is Mike Opel. I work in the Microsoft Cloud Group. I'm here with Randy Dimeno of Commvault. We're gonna take you through a little bit of not only kind of the cloud, things that are kind of driving the cloud and kind of our partnership with Commvault, but then Randy's gonna give some good demos about Commvault as well. So. Yeah.
Quick question for folks in the room. All right. Well, how many folks are here to win the Xbox? That's it? Only one?
It, yeah.
Okay.
One honest
one,
person.
Two. Two honest folks. Okay.
Yeah. 50.
How many folks here are current Azure users to some degree from a corporate standpoint? All right. How many folks here use Commvault? All right. It's a couple. All right. So for the existing guys, what's that?
Reseller and end user.
Okay. So you're a reseller and an end user. Okay. And you sell Azure too. Work with Microsoft. All right, so you'll hear about some things because we're going to show how to manage data on-prem using Azure as a storage tier. We're going to show some actually running the entire comm server media agent in Azure. So we'll show some of the the new stuff is Commvault was one of the first Windows applications added to the Microsoft Azure Marketplace in the Azure Gallery earlier this week as part of Microsoft's announcement. So we'll talk about the Azure environment first and how Commvault kind of helps that and so forth and. How many here guys use Exchange, O365 or on-prem? Just about everybody Exchange user. SharePoint? All right, so we're going to do a lot of that kind of integration with Azure and how to manage Exchange and SharePoint. So first things first, let's get some details on Azure. We'll have Mike kick it off to begin.
Thanks, Randy. And what we're going to do, we talk a little bit about kind of the importance of our work with Commvault, is I want to give you some kind of context, a little bit broader beyond just kind of the IT side. So I guess first we have to say kind of some forward-looking statements, so don't hold anything we say against us here today. And then we also want to give you about us. So this is me. I've been at Microsoft about coming up on 3 years now, so I'm drinking the Kool-Aid, but I still live in the real world a little bit, so hopefully I'm a good person for that. I work with a lot of our kind of key ISVs globally to help them launch their Azure products. And in my spare time, I'm a big sailor. That's me sailing my boat right there. And I have a Coast Guard captain's license as well. So, yeah.
Hey, all right.
See, aren't you glad you stayed? So what I want to talk about today, if I could, and this is Randy. Well, Randy, you do
it. Basically, I'm the chief technologist for our Windows products at Commvault. Mm-hmm. They're thinking of me as three things. I'm the old guy, because I've been in Commvault for 20 years now, and actually led our decision onto the Windows platform. I'm the Microsoft guy and the hockey guy. So those three things. So I'll get back up a little bit later. But
and people at Commvault, they kind of call Randy one of those three things. When he's not around, they have another thing they call him too, but it's not on the slide. So what I want to talk to you guys about today is what we see happening that's driving kind of the future trends. What do we see driving kind of the future of the business? And what we really see is the perfect storm. Now, the perfect storm is a terribly overused marketing term as of late, which is incredibly annoying to me because this is actually a personal story for me. So I live just north of Boston, Massachusetts, in a town called Manchester, Mass., which is the town next door to Gloucester, Mass. And if any of you have seen, hopefully everyone, has everyone seen the Perfect Storm movie, by the way? Okay, because if not, just leave, go watch on Next Look. It's better than anything we're going to teach you right here today. So obviously it's a story about the Andrew Gale, a sword boat out of Gloucester, Mass., that got stuck in what we called at that time the Halloween Storm of 1991, which eventually became the Perfect Storm. I lived in the town next door. I remember the Perfect Storm. I actually went down to the, there's a big jetty in Gloucester and stood there and felt the power of that storm coming in. So it's a very personal story for me. And it annoys me how it's overused in the marketing world because it's kind of come to mean just a big thing or people throw the term around all the time. What made the Halloween Storm of 1991 so perfect and so deadly for the crew of the Andrew Gale was it was the way three different storms came together. Traditionally, when storms come together, they kind of combine and they'll magnify their effects. But in the case of the perfect storm, the way each of these three came together, it was an order of magnitude increase. So they fed off each other in a different way than they had in the past, which created such a deadly and perfect storm. And we're actually seeing the exact same thing happening today in the world of technology. We're seeing three kind of different technology trends coming together and impacting the business in a way they never have before. So I want to talk about those three today. The first one is an easy one. It's what's in your pocket. It's what's in your bag. It's devices. So in 2003, we had about 10 internet. We had about 10 human beings on the planet for every one internet-connected device. Over time, that number went up. At about 2008, we had the tipping point. We had more internet-connected devices than human beings. And by 2010, of course, and 2015, we had significantly more devices. When we look into the future, at 2020, we see the number of 50 billion. We will have then 10x devices to people on the planet Earth. That's not going to be driven by phones, by tablets, Xboxes, and that stuff. It's what our friends at Cisco call the Internet of Things. This is all the things around us becoming connected to the Internet, and that's really an amazingly powerful driving force. We've all heard a lot about it, IoT, EOT, there's lots of good buzzwords about it now. What made this concept come to life for me was last Christmas. As I mentioned, I live in Boston in the States, where it gets cold in the winter. So at Christmas time, I saw my mother-in-law. Okay, my mother-in-law just got a new car. She got an Lexus RX SUV. She loves the car. And she has, this is the third one she's owned. So every 3 years, she goes and buys a new one, identical to the one before. The one she bought this year had an internet, was an interconnected device. She got the apps with it, and she could interact with her car with her phone. So as I pulled into the driveway of the house for Christmas, there's her car, lights are flashing on and off, doors are opening and closing. She was like a paid demoer at a conference showing people how to use the phone. It was like amazing. A woman who's not a technology person. And it was amazing because not only did she love it so much, but this little app that was now added onto this very expensive car made the value of that car multiples of what just the prior version had been without that the ability to interact. And actually what sold it for her was much like a Lexus commercial, where she had flown out of Boston and had parked on the top of the parking garage. When she came back, it had snowed, and there was snow all over the car. So the plane landed, she turned her phone on, turned the heat on, the defrost on, the heated seats on, and by the time she got her bag and got to her car, she had nothing to shovel off, nothing to wipe off. She got into her warm car, put her hands on her heated steering wheel, which is pretty cool, and drove away. That's the Internet of Things. That's these different things that are now talking to one another. One of the other really cool examples I just learned about a week ago was GE, so GE Aircraft Engines. I was speaking to a couple execs in that group. Yes, of course. You have a question? Sorry? Okay, sorry about that. No, feel free to scratch. So itches, no problem. So I was speaking to some of the folks at GE, and they were talking about their next generation of aircraft engine, which is coming out imminently, and in fact, it's kind of out now. All of these jet engines will be internet-connected devices. Now, obviously, the first application, you think of the Malaysian Air flight that disappeared. Obviously, that would not be the case if all the engines were in continuous contact through the internet. But what's also, what's amazing is the reason they're doing this is the actual wings themselves. So when a plane is in the cruise mode, it's very subtle microscopic adjustments to the wings impact the efficiency of the engine. So what they're going to do with these new engines is when the plane gets on autopilot, the autopilot and the internet-connected device on the engine will talk to each other and make microscopic adjustments on the wings, which will save the airline industry $5 billion U.S. per year. That, however, is just a drop in the bucket compared to the real cost. Because the true thing is that when something goes wrong with one of these engines, it will send the message to the ground crew waiting for the plane. So when the plane lands, the ground crew comes down with the exact part, fixes the engine, and you're off. And that, the impact that should have on the efficiency of flight and flight schedules is going to be make that $5 billion look like nothing. So obviously we have things like planes, cars, things with power are easy to think about becoming internet-connected devices, but it's not limited to that. This is a cow, obviously, right? There's a company in the Netherlands called Sparked, and what Sparked does is put little internet-connected devices on every cow. These sensors send messages back to the farmer, telling him which cows are sick, is there one pregnant, any of that kind of issues. In addition to that, they can track with the GPS exactly where the cows are going, so that the farmer doesn't need to put grain and feed all over the place, but just where the animals are going. So these are the kind of innovative ways people are using the Internet of Things. Okay, and of course, what are these things doing all day long, whether they be jet engines, cars, or cows? They are creating data. Lots and lots and lots of data, which is where we kind of get to Commvault. So that cow we just saw, each cow creates 200 megabytes of data per year. This explosion of data is just remarkable in history. So in 2009, the human species, meaning from the first time a caveman drew a woolly mammoth on a cave up until 2009, of which we have a lot of internet years in there, so there's a lot of internet traffic, the human species had created about 0.8 zettabytes of data total. That means every piece of data ever created in human history equaled 0.8 zettabytes. By 2015, that number is going to be almost eight zettabytes. And by 2020, it'll be 44x what it was in 2009 at 35 zettabytes of data. Now, if you're anything like myself, the first reaction you have when you see that number is, well, what the hell is a zettabyte, right? So a zettabyte is 1 billion terabytes, which is an interesting little fact when you think about the company Teradata. Like cool company, they were named Teradata because it seemed like a lot of data when they named the company. That's obsolete. They have to go back and rename their company now. And it is this deluge of data that we see coming, which is really going to be, I think, the challenge of a lot of our times. our companies are going to have to deal with this data. They're either going to learn to take this data and use it for a competitive advantage, or they're going to get washed away by it. Now, the other term, even more overused than the perfect storm, has got to be big data. It's like easily the most annoying term recently. Of all the definitions I've read, though, there's one I think was really good for McKinsey, and that is that big data applies to data sets beyond the capabilities of traditional technologies to deal with. I think that's actually a pretty accurate statement of what big data is. The way we've done business before and the way we've managed our data in 2015 will not apply in 2020. So we have to start thinking differently about how we do it. And Randy's going to get into that with Commvault. So we've got devices creating data. The third trend we see out there is one that we kind of all feel, but it's very difficult to quantify, right? And that is the speed of changes, the accelerated speed of change we all feel. We see it at work, we feel it in our personal lives, right? The speed at which things are moving is just happening a lot, lot faster. And a year ago, I saw this, I think the best example of this was the America's Cup. So we have at least any other sailors in the room at all. So the America's Cup is a race, it's the oldest trophy in sports, started in 1851. It's a race held about every 3 years. And it's called the America's Cup, ironically, not because of the country America, but because the folks who held this race, the first race, faced the same challenge every event planner has ever faced of, like, what if nobody comes to my event? The same thing Ray and I were worried about you guys not coming today. So to try to sweeten the deal, they said, whichever boat wins the first race, we will name the trophy after the boat. So the boat that won happened to be called the America, and that's why it's called the America's Cup. So again, held every 3 years. When it was held in 2013, last year, I, of course, was an avid watcher of this, and I kind of have three passions in life. There's my family, boating, and technology. And as this race was coming, I started to see that the boating and technology part were kind of coming together, and this was going to be like a wonderful television experience for me personally. And I thought, I'm going to get my family involved, too. So I have a 5-year-old son. I want to get him into the racing. And at first, he was totally into it because, like, you know, the boats are really cool looking. They've got good paint jobs. They're going really fast. And after about 5 minutes, I lost him. Like, he was not paying attention anymore. And I'm like, Hunter, what do you think? And he goes, Dada, when is the one boat going to sink the other boat? And I'm like, oh, no, they're not going to sink each other. And he lost interest. But it was still a great thing for me to watch. So what was amazing to me was how the America's Cup illustrates that pace of change and the change of speed we feel. So again, in 1851, the yachts were moving at a stately 12 kilometers an hour around the course, wooden sailboats. Over the next 150 years, as technology improved, with fiberglass, better sails, better design, the speed of the boats about doubled. So in 2007, the whole thing's been given away now. So in 2007, the boats were going about 25 kilometers an hour, about twice as fast, okay? And if you think about the world in 2007, that was kind of the beginning of mainstream modeling, of large compute to do large models. So this is an exotic materials like carbon fiber started to become kind of more commonplace. So the speed from 2007, we saw double in just a 3-year period to boats going 50 kilometers an hour. That's actually kind of an amazing thing. Over 150 years, it took to double, and then it doubled again in just 3 years. And I would say most sailors, including myself, thought this is about as fast as these boats are going to go. Why? Because the boat's powered by the wind, and the wind is going about 50 kilometers an hour. So obviously the boat can't go faster than the force pushing it, right? But again, think about 2010. Now we had tremendously detailed modeling capabilities. The exotic materials have come further. So that in 2013, last year, the boats were traveling at almost 100 kilometers an hour. It had doubled again in just 3 short years. An amazing, amazing speed transition, right? And when you think about, and it illustrates also the way we feel. We feel this hockey stick of change coming at us, right? Now, the problem is when you are moving at speeds like this, right, what happens a lot? Because you're not used to it. Well, you get a lot of this, unfortunately. We had a few boats go over like this. Why? Because these sailors, just like all of us in our business lives, we lived our entire life moving at one speed. And now we're moving at a speed far faster than we had before. So we weren't used to this speed. We didn't know how to deal with it. We were trying to react to it. We were reacting to circumstances as opposed to controlling it. So what did they do is very similar to what we all need to do in this new world of devices, data, and accelerated change. You first have to go back and think about the man, the ultimate change person, Charles Darwin, who talked about the theory of evolution. Charles Darwin's quote, which, by the way, was just a few short years before the first America's Cup, is so spot on today, it's amazing. It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It is the one most adaptable to change. So how did those sailors, and how should we adapt to this change? Well, what they did was they took the perfect storm and started to use it against itself. They took the boats out, they retooled. They put in the middle here, they set up two servers and a Wi-Fi network on the boat. They put 200 sensors all over the boat to measure load, balance, all over the boat. And they had, and on that Wi-Fi network, they put devices on some of the sailors so they could see green, yellow, red. Am I within a good range? Is the load getting too large? Should I need to make a change right now before the boat goes over? Because the speed of change was faster than they could handle. So they used the technology to beat the technology. They harnessed the perfect storm. And by using those tools against the storm, they found success. What's most amazing about the speed these boats are traveling now, by the way, the way they are able to do it, is because of acceleration. So what happens is, even though the wind's only 25 miles an hour, when the boat accelerates, there's that moment of acceleration, it creates its own wind and starts to sail in that own wind. So they come up on a hydroflow and they start to move along faster. The analogy is like if we went outside today, there's like very little wind, but if we hop in a taxi and have that taxi go 100 kilometers an hour, we stick our head out the window, we feel 100 kilometers of wind, right? That's what these boats are doing. They are creating their own wind that they sail in. And the amazing thing about the speed is that the faster they go, the faster they can go because they're propelling themselves forward. And I think that when we talk about the future of our companies and how we're going to use technology, just like these guys, the faster you go, the faster you'll be able to go. That's why we work so much with Commvault, because the foundational aspect of that is you have to get your data under control. You have to have it in a way that you can use it when you need it, have it stored, backed up. Without that as a foundational element, you'll never be able to move at the speed of business that we see today. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Randy. But before I do, I want to give you just a quick kind of background on our relationship with Commvault, because it's a pretty unique one, actually. As Randy can tell you more, Microsoft was actually an early investor in Commvault. We are not anymore, but we were earlier. And throughout, I think, they were very early to the world of using Microsoft Azure. But I think most interesting to me is that Microsoft is actually a very big customer of Commvault as well. We use Commvault in our data centers. So Global Foundation Services, which is the team that runs our data centers worldwide, they manage over 11 million servers, not cores, servers, use Commvault. Xbox Live, all run on Commvault. And internally, I said, we use them as well. So it's a wonderful partnership, and we have a big belief that before you have to master the data before you can master your own company. And with that, I'll turn over to Randy.
Mike, thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that, and we've done, the key there is that Commvault is also an Azure customer. So we actually get a lot of best-of-breed capabilities about what we learn from each other and actually take those benefits and pass them on to our customers. I like to talk about the Xbox and Xbox Live environment, probably one of the most complex SQL environments on the planet. And if you think of Xbox Live, it might be the largest managed service provider on the planet. So I get to tease my teenage children. Be careful what you put in Xbox and Xbox Live, because Daddy's backing it up, and I can kind of find out what's in there based on search. But it really is important as we get into it's being able to search that data and find it as we go through the presentation a little bit more and we get into the demonstrations. So, again, I'm the old guy, I'm the Microsoft guy, I'm the hockey guy, so we'll move on. But first things first, let's define backup data management, all right? Because some people will say moving files or recovering a server is backup and recovery. Our definition with Microsoft is a little bit different. It's disaster recovery, it's granular management, individual exchange messages, SharePoint items, maybe Active Directory objects and attributes. So application-specific knowledge is very, very important. Archive. I can talk to six people about archive and get six different definitions. Storage management, use cheaper secondary storage. Archive can be content indexing. Archive can be discovery. So meet compliance requirements. And the U.S., we have our set of e-discovery compliance requirements. The EU has their set, and you have to manage that data very, very efficiently and smartly now. Encryption, deduplication. As we move more towards the Azure model, where data is stored in a less expensive, fast location like Azure, having that data protected and encrypted is very important. So we worked with Microsoft very early on, and our design, and one of the reasons why GFS, Global Foundation Services at Microsoft uses us, is for our use of encryption keys. So when you move data to Azure, the encryption keys remain on-prem, ensuring that you guys, your customer, your site is the only one that has access to it. A lot of MSPs use our capability, so chargeback reporting has to be built in. Replication management. And a key point about replication, all right, because there's a lot of high availability. Replication is a critical component of an overall data management strategy. Replication is not backup. Take the case of Exchange, for example, or SharePoint. If I have some corruption or in a file system or an exchange and I replicate that, and I'm only using replication for protection, I just replicated those issues. So you still need an application-consistent way of ensuring your data is being able to be brought back when you need it. Desktop, laptop, edge capability. A lot of our customers now with Azure, no need if they're remote and semi-tethered to the Internet of Things, why send all that data on-prem to their corporate office and then send it off-site for Azure? Just send it directly there. And for the existing Commvault customers in the room, we'll actually talk about putting the media agent itself in Azure. So, again, different philosophy from about Commvault to Microsoft with some of the other guys out there. If you're not a Commvault customer, you probably have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of those different products in your organization today. You got your backup team, you got your archive team, I got my BI and e-discovery team, and there's a lot of products out there that I mentioned. Some good products, some not so good products, some legacy products, some brand new products. But generally, folks, before they have Commvault, have 3, 4, 5, 6 of those different solutions in their environment. They'll have a backup copy of data, an archive copy of data, an e-discovery copy of data, et cetera, et cetera. So as we Commvault to Microsoft, a little bit of a different philosophy. First off, let's use Windows Server and or Windows Azure as our foundation. All right? So interesting point for Microsoft, because now Microsoft gets into the chargeback reporting scenario as an extension of System Center. Microsoft gets into the archiving e-discovery capability. So using Server or Azure as our platform enabled us to build Simpana, which is our software set. So a single software solution that does what all of these products do. But instead of having 4 or 5 different copies of the data, we'll have one single copy of the data. Significant reduction in storage. Significant reduction in use of high-end, expensive on-prem SAN devices and storage devices. So a radically different way of doing things. Different philosophy. All right, Commvault with Microsoft built a data management product. We didn't build a backup product like NetBackup or Legato that just said, initially their legacy was backup to tape as quickly as possible. No, we built a data management search, e-discovery, recovery product, recall product, and it makes a big difference. So, big philosophy change. One single product, build organically on top of Windows, or go out and acquire different disparate technologies, which a lot of the other guys have done. Now, we'll get into some of the modes we see corporations using today. And standard model one is I have to back up and archive data, and I'll go disk to tape. So I got my on-prem location, I simply back up to tape. All right? And in the US, I can speak specifically because this becomes quite expensive because customers have to take those tapes and move them off-site. All right? If I was in the US, I said, how many people are pushing their tapes to Iron Mountain? Probably half the room would say, yeah, I'm doing that. I'm managing tapes that way. Do you ever do a restore from them? Most people say no. And I'm like, good luck with that. So the tape manage becomes an expense as opposed to putting it in a single location with quick recovery. But that's model one today. Model two, as some disk gets a little bit less expensive, was disk to disk. Simply back up from your on-prem location to usually cheaper, less expensive disk on-prem. All right, so you're kind of good. Keep the first copy of the data close by. Not a bad concept. Well, what folks now are doing, they'll go, you know, disk to tape. That became kind of the standard in the 2007, 2008, 2010 timeframe. All right, have a close-by copy on-prem on spinning disk, but then move it off to tape. And the more modern way today is how do we incorporate what's the best way to leverage Azure? So a lot of our folks will go disk to disk or directly disk to Azure. I get out of managing tapes. I get out of managing barcodes. I simply have a safe location. And I've talked to Mike about Microsoft's data center in Dublin, Ireland, which I think he'll actually do a much better job of describing. And actually, you know, Mike come up and talk about it. But I'm fascinated by the data center they have where Commvault customers are storing data in Ireland. Because the first thing I learned about their data center was they built a multi-million, hundreds of million dollar data center, and it's protected by a moat, which if you drive, like, you explain it. You do a better job than I do.
So the building is actually $1 billion.
So it's a $1 billion building, which is as long as the Empire State Building is high if you were to lay it down. And what's amazing about this building, not only is the security, so there's a moat around the building to prevent tanks from breaching. So there's a little bridge you drive over that a car or bus can go over, but anything bigger, it'll crash down to the bottom. It's security is actually mind-blowing. Even for I, as a Microsoft employee, who often will host events at this data center, I don't know the address of the place, and they won't tell me. I tell them where I'm going to be. They come and pick me up. It's the policy. They don't tell anybody their address. Yeah. And they send kind of like a black, tinted window thing to pick you up. It's very, very amazing. But what also is amazing about the data center is that speed of change. So the one in Dublin opened up in 2009. And as they saw the incredible ramp of volume of people using the cloud going up, they wanted to get the thing online as quickly as possible. So instead of building it one giant building, they decided to build one giant data center. They decided to build three equal data center rooms, basically, three identical rooms, so that they get the first one up and running first and then build the second and the third kind of thing. And what happened was in the building the first one, they learned so much about power management that they threw out the plans for room two, and they built a different one in room two, which has almost double the number of servers, which is measured in hundreds of thousands, not tens of thousands, in just these rooms, and uses less power than the one directly next door. They learned so much building the second room that they threw those plans out and built a third one totally differently again, which has significantly more capacity using significantly less power. And they've learned so much building this building, which has cost $1 billion, that they've decided to build a whole new one, which they're building right now. It's going to be online next year, directly across the street. It's going to be twice the size and have twice the amount of power being used. Okay. And when they get done with this building next year, they hire the same contractors to drive their bulldozers back across the street, and they're going to level the $1 billion building that was constructed in 2009 because it's already obsolete. It's already obsolete in the world. And it's actually causing an accounting problem because Microsoft had amortized that investment over, a long period of time, not over 5 years. It's now obsolete. Wow. It's kind of incredible. The interesting trivia about the Dublin data center is they stopped counting servers. There's just too many. So they count power now is kind of how they quantify these things. So the existing data center uses 38 megawatts of power per day. The one across the street is going to be using 70 megawatts of power. So here's a trivia question. Of that 38 megawatts, what percentage do you think goes to cooling the facility? The servers and stuff like that.
What's that? 80? How much? Less? What?
Less than?
How much less?
Would anyone 10%? Guess 0%? 0%. Yeah. Only if it was pretty close. But it's kind of a trick question because, the way we think about data centers is just the heat and the cooling is the expense. They use 0%. It's an amazing thing. So what they did, they did research on the servers and determined that we're not going to keep these things for more than 2 years. So forget the manufacturer's warranty. It doesn't matter to us. And we found that the server runs incredibly efficiently at like 100%. Like if you floor it, it'll go, it's perfectly efficient. It's not going to last forever, but that's okay. They don't want to keep them for 2 years. So they have these things run in full speed, and they also found they actually will run a little bit more efficiently when it's hotter in the room than you would expect. So it's not as cool as you'd expect, and which meant that the climate in Dublin is just perfect for data center cooling. So they use natural air cooling throughout the building. And there are only 6 days per year where the temperature in Dublin gets over the point where this doesn't work. And the Irish actually have a term for these days. They call them summer, is what they call these 6 days. And what they do, which is amazing, is they actually put over the air vents that come into this building, it's a cloth. It's wetted cloth with tap water. And it's just like they did in Mesopotamia, thousands of years ago. It just cools the air coming in, hits that wetted surface just enough that it then works perfectly again. So there's all sorts of redundant, air conditioning systems. They've never had to turn them on. And they'd anticipate that when the building is closed next year, it'll have gone its entire life without having to turn on any of the giant AC units that are on the top of the building. It's incredible. Same with the backup power supply, by the way. So in the States, it turns out the power supply is not as clean as it is in Europe. So they actually regularly will fire up some of the diesel generators, because the power coming is as good. The one in Europe is much, much better. They've never had to turn them on. They practice like once a week they turn them on. But they anticipate at the end of that 5-year building, they'll never have used these. There's 18 generators. Each one is a $1 million piece of equipment that, again, will have never been used.
Question?
Yep.
For European
Yes, many data centers.
So, so in other words, are we? Say it one more time. I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow the.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yep.
That's my data.
Yep.
Goes to the U.S.
Yeah.
And in the U.S.
Yep.
It's very difficult.
Yes.
So is it so that Microsoft has also for Windows Azure can tell that my data go not to the U.S.?
Yeah. Correct. You configure that.
So that's a really good point, okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a U.S. guy, but I understand there's, you know, some concern with sending your, right? Fair enough. So the way that works is the Microsoft has broken the kind of world up into different regions, and each region has primary, secondary, and then a backup data center. So Dublin's one of three in the European sphere, and you can absolutely manage, you can ensure that none of it will go to the U.S. if you'd like. And in fact, you know, in Europe, the primary, the Model 29 working group, has basically set the standards for what, you know, I think one of the problems we've had actually with cloud adoption is people are kind of unsure. Like, what can I do? What can I put there? Like, there's some question about it. So I'd encourage all of you actually check out the Model 29 working group. It was an EU working group to say, what are the standards for cloud computing? What can you put there? What can't you? What are the rules? And Microsoft worked very closely with this group, and, you know, as of the other cloud providers, obviously. And they've now published these guidelines. They came out in, I guess, April, I want to say, either April or end of May, which say here's all how it works, and basically you can be Model 29 compliant. And in fact, Microsoft Azure is currently the only public cloud provider that is Model 29 compliant. I imagine the others will be. And the reason we are is for the reason you state. Whereas it's difficult. It's a difficulty to say we're going to keep the data here in Europe as opposed to backing up elsewhere. So we made a lot of changes to enable that to happen. I imagine the other ones will at some point as well. But so currently you can absolutely do that. And I would add also that a lot of that earlier concern, like, well, I don't want to back up in the U.S. or, you know, APAC, whatever. That was due to just the number of data centers, whereas now we have so many, and there's so many more coming online. And the number is going to almost triple over the next 2 years, just because the volume is just going crazy. So, you know, as more and more are put in each geo, we can get very country specific as well. So right now it's European specific, but we're working to get country specific as well for like Germany, Switzerland, that kind of thing, because you have those, you know, interesting jurisdictions there as well. Yeah. And same thing in Asia. So, you know, Asia has a similar challenges, issues, and it's a matter of getting the compute at scale needed in a specific region. Because what you want to do is so the way they're working, they auto-replicate continually. So if you were using Azure, you know, Dublin's the primary, but there's a secondary that's automatically backing up 24 hours a day anyways. And then if we wanted to ever shut Dublin down, we could switch over to the secondary, which is then backing up to the primary. There's a third one also. So the redundancy is actually so massive now, because we have so many more of them, that I think in the future you'll see less and less about like big generators and just more and more software, because there's so much capacity elsewhere you can just, you know, replicate much easier. So.
Yeah, I mean, to bring it back to a little bit of the Commvault perspective, we have that in our capability where we'll make one copy on-prem and then send a secondary copy to Azure. In the old days, we call that auxiliary copy or dash copies, where we make secondary, tertiary copies. When we move data to Azure, that automatically happens times three. So there'll be three additional copies. Now, you have the option of adding what Microsoft calls geo-replication, put it into a different data center, or even in a completely different geo. So you have the option to say, I want some data to go in the U.S. And we're completely transparent with that. So even if the primary or secondary would go away, which existing Commvault customers have been taking advantage of for 15 years, that same philosophy holds true with Commvault and Azure now. All right, I mean, I kind of like this slide. I was thinking about it as Mike was talking. I actually, for the future times we do this, I actually might, I don't think there's a good graphic for a moat. I'd like to put the Azure
dragon, alligators.
Yeah. Put a data center there with a moat, because technically, you know, Mike is a Commvault user with Microsoft's GFS standardizing on Commvault. Technically, his data is being protected by Commvault, and he can get it back from wherever. I'm not sure how the geo replication specifics are with his specific piece of data in Microsoft, but technically, his data could be secondary, tertiary, protected, and manageable from the data center that's protected by a moat in Ireland, even though he's in Massachusetts and Microsoft corporate headquarters is in Redmond, Washington.
And, you know,
interesting,
the other thing
interesting concept.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, kind of a common issue maybe is, and I think it was actually, I think in looking back as like, as all of us, not just Microsoft, like as everybody launched the cloud, I think we did it wrong. I think we kind of made it like, you're going to move, everyone's going to go to the cloud. And I actually think that there'll be, so Microsoft is all in the cloud. There's actually no, we have nothing out, everything is the cloud. Which is interesting because we're a software company, so our IP is not in an on-prem protected spot. But I think there's, I think it's unlikely that there'll be many companies like Microsoft. I think most people are going to, they're going to choose where they, what they want to have in the cloud, and maybe I think that'll be a, the vast majority of stuff over time. But I think for most companies like Coca-Cola, they're going to want to keep their secret Coke formula in like a closet on-premise somewhere. You know, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think we should have started with move what you want when you want versus everyone's going to go. I think that was a mistake actually looking back on how we went. So there's always going to be, I think, for most companies, they're going to want to keep something local. You know what I mean? And I think that's fine. Actually. But I think when we make the discussion about moving everything to the cloud, we slow the whole thing down. If we make it about what makes sense to move today, you know, the cost. I mean, how can you leverage the very inexpensive computing power, not for everything, but for what you need? That's kind of where we see just a lot of traction. So
back to our model, which is a common one today, disk to disk, and that's for heterogeneous data. Windows, Exchange, SharePoint, but also Unix, Linux, NetWare, Mac, Oracle, the entire enterprise. AS400, or I'm from New York. Unfortunately, a lot of guys in Manhattan haven't moved off AS400 yet. So have that data local. Send a secondary copy up into Azure, a D2D2A scenario. What gets a little more interesting is as more Azure compute cycles get run in Azure, you want to be able to manage that seamlessly. So you want to manage your data on-prem the same way you might manage it in Azure. Secondary, disaster recovery copies going back and forth, and you're taking advantage of the model that Microsoft's providing us, which is compute and storage for that. So with backup and recovery, let's get a little bit more definition. We got servers, Unix, Linux, NetWare, servers, application support. All right, and this is full disaster recovery. I have to bring up an entire data center, which is why we added provisioning. I can actually take those VMs on-prem, back them up, archive them, provision and recover them on the fly, and provision that VM at the target, at that Windows target, basically no matter where it is. Message level management, SharePoint item level management, SQL, file, table space. All right, virtual servers are huge. Mike won't yell at you, how many people here have VMware? How many folks have Hyper-V? All right, about the same today, that's what we see. All right, and Hyper-V is catching up, probably soon to surpass VMware based on two things. It's caught up and surpassed in functionality. And Microsoft kind of has this other thing that's a benefit for them. It's free with Windows Server. All right, so we're seeing a sea change right now. A lot of our customers say, hey, I'm doing that migration. Can you help me as I move to Hyper-V? So we put in the functionality, extending our release independence, where everything we back up, archive at the file, volume, and entire virtual server level from VMware can be recovered and provisioned directly to Hyper-V. All right, huge point there, because it's cost savings, but you're still managing that data. Still remember in your 3, 5, 7, 21-year data retention requirements that you may have. All right, speaking of release independence, we ran into a situation where, and this is where it was great to have a very tight relationship with Microsoft. About 10 months ago, we had dozens of customers using a cloud provider. And myself and David Ngo got a phone call from the cloud provider. Hi, how are you? How are you doing Friday afternoon? Okay. Well, we just want to let you know, about 2 weeks from now, we're shutting off the lights, turning off the power, going out of business. The company was Nervonix. So here we are with dozens of customers now with what they're going to do. So we worked very quickly with Microsoft, and again, for the existing Commvault customers, in effect, doing auxiliary copy from Nervonix, moving the data into Azure, so they could actually, keep running seamlessly. So as you choose your cloud providers, you got to choose that, you got to make sure they're going to be there 5, 10, 20 years. Are they going to grow with you? All right. So we talked about the VMware data migration to Hyper-V, managing workstations, laptops, edge devices. But when you move the data, and I'll show shortly, is the key is to index that data based on content. You're going to lose knowledge of where the data, what that data is residing in, physically and what application. So you have to be able to search by content. You want to make one copy of it, all right? Commvault will move the data once and have archive policies against that, or archive policies against that, or e-discovery policies. Right? You shouldn't have to have multiple copies of the data, one for backup, one for archive. You guys take care of the key management. All right. Again, very, very heavy on security. And really what we're doing is enabling a zero disk growth paradigm. Set your archiving in place so you can zero disk growth on-prem with that higher, more expensive spinning disk. And another key, we all talk about deduplication. All right. A couple of different ways in the industry to do it today. One I like to point out is EMC. They went out and acquired another disparate piece of technology called Data Domain. $150,000 Linux-based, heavy, you're a sailor, I call it a boat anchor. All right, $150,000 Linux-based box that you have to buy in pairs. Our philosophy is a little different. Use a simple Windows server. Apologies, not that there's anything simple about a Windows server, but it's significantly less expensive than $150,000 piece of Linux box that you have to buy in pairs. So use those Windows servers, you know, use that target as a in a smart, more efficient way and less costly way. Use the software to do it.
You know, one thing I was going to say too, and then I'll stop talking about data centers, but simplicity is kind of back in style, which is interesting. When you talk about the compute at scale, like these giant data centers, right, is what they think about is they try to make things very, very simple, because when things get complicated is when they can go wrong. So, for example, you know, not only is the cooling a good example of simplicity, but also the diesel generators, they have, you know, there's all of these kill switches. So in the case one of them caught on fire, you know, you got to shut that machine down. And what they did was they hired consulting firms to come in to design a foolproof system that would, you know, always shut the machine down, if the fuel supply to the machine off if it caught on fire. And they have all these quotes for, like, you know, millions of dollars to build these kind of things. And when you go there, it's funny because what you see is they have like a kill switch, right? You know, it'll stop the fuel going in. It's like a red button. And hanging above the red button is a giant sledgehammer, like just hanging in the air above it like this. And the sledgehammer is attached to a string that goes up and to a little sensor, like just one like from any engine in your that sits over top of the engine, it's the generator. And if fire happens, it heats up, it melts the string, and it falls and shuts the engine off. Like, brilliant simplicity. You know what I mean? And it's like, well, we see a lot of it, like trying to get to that very simple, so nothing can go wrong in that scenario. There's no switches, there's no nothing. And we see a lot of that actually. And when you're talking that scale, they try to get it very, very simple. So simple is a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it is. That's what we're going to try to show shortly. Yep. All right, compliance is key. Just about every organization we meet today that's making $1 of revenue is under some sort of compliance guidelines. So you want to be able to search data that includes all email in and out of Exchange, both on-prem and Office 365. And for the existing Commvault folks here, full O365 integration with Commvault Now. And we've talked about it before, data sovereignty. You set where you want to store your data. Do you want to send it across the pond? Do you not want to send it across the pond? That data sovereignty is key. I'll be able to manage that. So enough of the PowerPoint. Let's get into a few demonstrations to actually showcase this. All right. And what I'm going to show is the old-fashioned way. I usually have one of my other guys here, David Noh. He's the younger, young whippersnapper. He'll show the modern stuff. So I'm going to do the old-fashioned way of doing things, which is very, very effective, very cost-effective, and then we'll take a little bit of look at how we're using Azure more strategically. So we'll talk about Exchange, SharePoint, and Active Directory, and search in a true hybrid environment. So we'll start off with email, all right? And I have been at Commvault, as I said, a really long time, going on 21 years. And been there a long time. And I have about a 50 to 55 gig mailbox myself. I do that for two reasons. Reason number one, I am a spoiled brat and I keep everything, all right? Reason number two is I do like to stress our system to see what happens in extreme environments. So I'm gonna take an email that I received from a lady named Cammie. And you guys can see a wonderful screen here, by the way. And you can see I got it in May of 2004, over 10 years ago. So I got it and backed it up originally on Exchange 2003. I'm going to tombstone it or permanently delete it. It is now gone, been removed, all right? So one of the questions our folks will usually get is, hey, how can I get something back? You know, how quickly can I get little tiny, we wanna enable you to microscopically manage your data as well as do the full disaster recovery data center management. So let's take a look at the old fashioned way of doing things. Here's the Commvault interface, all right? Browser-based interface. I can run it from home, I can run it from the hotel room, I can run it from the office. All of my servers and all of my applications and even all of my workstations I can manage from a single location. And for the existing Commvault folks in the room, this is V10, SP6. generally available. So in this case, I want to manage Exchange at a very granular level. All right, and I'm just going to do a quick browse and restore. Now, for the folks not familiar with Commvault, start to remember these screens because you will see consistency across the board. When do I want to see it? From a week ago, a month ago, a year ago? I'm just going to take a look at all of it. So here's all the users on this server. I'll go into my mailbox. Something I notice very quickly. The eDiscovery Outlook extended information like calendar items, contacts, conversations are also being managed and protected. And from an eDiscovery perspective, that's very vital information to have should you be under some sort of an HR or a legal discovery scenario. But in this case now, I'm just going to go into the inbox. And as I said, I've got tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of messages, even in my inbox. So I'm just going to take this one message, do a simple sort and reverse from May of 2004. There's the message. Make a restore request. I'm going to put it right back where it came from. So what I've done here now, and you speak about data sovereignty, this is interesting. I'm here in Barcelona. I need to recover an individual message from 10 years ago when I backed it up on Exchange 2003. So I've asked Simpana to go out and find that message, which happens to be living in an Azure data center in the U.S. right now. So I'm going over the same poor network performance that I'm sharing with you guys right now here in this room in this area. Find that message, find it in Azure, across the pond, restore it into my current Exchange Server 2013 mailbox. And while I've been speaking, talking to you about the demo, the data has been restored. All security properties associated with that message, all metadata with that message, back exactly as it was. So you start to get into the frame of Commvault's definition of data management. It's not just servers. Why don't you manage lots of little things as it pertains to Exchange? Now, that's the old-fashioned way of doing things. All right? And administrators would come to us in the first 3 to 6 months. Commvault, you guys rock. You say, you know, I can do things much faster. You know what happens a year later? They come up to us and say, I want to kill you. I'm like, why? Something broken? Something not working? They say, no. A year ago, nobody in my organization knew I could do this. Now I'm getting hundreds of people that are asking me to do this every month. Stop. What do we do here? What happens here? We're like, all right. So we came up with something called Content Store, which I wish I could say we invented it, but it was actually demand by our customers came back and said, we need a way for our users to manage and have access to their data. And Content Store, you can almost think of it as before, it actually came out before the term self-service IT came out. So Content Store is, here, if you see my inbox, these are all my live folders. And this would be either on-prem Exchange or O365. I go into Content Store. Let me move up to the top of my mailbox for now. We see this one message, room at SPC. I'll go into the Content Store. And this is now, as an end user, me having access to all of my email that is online, nearline, archived, whether it's archived in the box Exchange or archived by some other product, archived by Commvault, and has been completely deleted and removed. So I now have access to an unchangeable e-discovery proof set of data. I can open up the email. I can reply to it. I can forward it to somebody. I can't change it. I can't delete it. I can even take that message and drag it into my current mailbox. Go into my current mailbox, and in effect, now I have two copies of the message. So here's a self-service capability. Users access their own email. Okay, this is demand by our customer base. Came back and said, no, hey, this is great, but we want our users to do this in some, a lot, or all of our individual use cases. So the term is called Content Store. It's been out for a while. So very microscopic management of Exchange. All right? And speaking of Exchange, storage is very, very important. Trivia questions coming out. When it comes to Exchange, if you're on Exchange 2000, 2003, 2007, and you send a message, say you send a message to 1,000 people on your Exchange server, how many copies of that message are in Exchange? 2000, 2003, 2007.
One
copy in 2000, 2003. Close. Two. The one you sent and the one everybody else got. Trick question. Exchange 2010, Exchange 2013. How many folks have migrated to 2010 and 2013? A lot more message. You needed a lot more storage really quick. A lot more performance, a lot more feature functionality, a lot more integration with SharePoint, but single instance storage was removed. So if you send that same message to 1,000 people, how many copies of the message are in Exchange now? 1,001. Bigger database, a lot more data. All right, so you want to be able to manage that microscopically. When Commvault moves data, we deduplicate it at the global level. All right, so if I had Roger dot PowerPoint 10 times in Exchange, 52 times in SharePoint, and 72 times in file systems. How many copies, when I deduplicate that globally, how many copies of that do I have in my storage area? One. So we will help you recoup that storage from the data management perspective for backup and tiering. So big pieces here is, you know, to the growth, care, and feeding and the management of your enterprise, which is hence why we call it data management. We'll jump over to SharePoint. All right, and Azure's the talk of the week. There's no question. So here's SharePoint. I'm going to take this one item, and I'm going to delete it. Send it to the recycle bin. Since nobody here believes me, I'm from New York, so nobody's going to believe anything somebody from New York. I'm going to delete it out of the recycle bin, too, so it's completely gone. So Azure V4 has been completely removed. We'll come back to Commvault, and I'll now shut down my Exchange. I'll go into SharePoint. I'll browse. Identical screen to how I manage Exchange. I don't have to learn something new. My IT team can share one single product. When do I want to see the data? I'll see all of it. I got a couple of sites. I'll scroll down, go to the Microsoft area. There's the Azure V4 dock. Make the recovery request. I can put it to the same or a different SharePoint location if I choose. I'll just put it right back where it came from now. Click OK. So again, similar to Exchange, I took an item that I originally backed up on SharePoint 10. It's a PDF, Azure V4. Find it. It's sitting in a data center in the US in Azure. Find it. Restore it back to my SharePoint server on-prem. We're using Azure as a tier. And release independence comes in because I'm recovering into SharePoint 2013. All right. We have a vested interest at Commvault for having you more rapidly upgrade to the latest Microsoft technologies. Mike and his development teams give us more APIs to do more way cool stuff with. So I want to see you on SharePoint 2013. I want to see you on Exchange 2013, right? Because there's more stuff I can offer with you. So we want to help that migration. We want to help you upgrade much more quickly. While I've been speaking, the restore completed. We'll come back to SharePoint. I have to refresh the screen, which I will do. Up here, you can see refresh, click, and there's Azure V4 back exactly as it was. Question? From O365 Exchange perspective, yes, and the contents to all the features. Some things we can do around O365 SharePoint, we're not under non-disclosure, all right? We have a very draconian auditing team that interprets rules certain ways. There's things we can do today, and I'm only allowed to talk about feature set product that goes through, what month is this, October? Actually, I can only talk about, no, it's October. I can only talk about right now stuff through the end of December. I'm limited to that quarter. All right. Suggestion there is I'd like to have an NDA discussion with you in more detail because there's some stuff coming. There's, you know, the O365 Exchange infrastructure is very API feature rich. And Microsoft put a lot of emphasis on that early on. And the O365 SharePoint side is becoming that way. So there's some stuff we can do today and there's some stuff that, you know, just follow our path. So, but good question. Good question. One other one I'll show, one other piece. At the heart of every Exchange SharePoint environment, Windows Server, is Active Directory. So one of the demonstrations I like to do, to enhance the ease and use in management, is I'm going to give myself a promotion. I'm going to change an attribute in Active Directory. I am now the Commvault Zamboni driver. Always wanted to drive one of those things, but never did, to be honest. So change an attribute in AD. And sometimes third-party products for Exchange, mostly SharePoint, will actually extend the schema, actually tweak it. So you may want to be able to manage it. So we'll come back to Commvault, go into Exchange, I'm sorry, Active Directory, browse. Same exact screen. Again, I don't have to learn something new. That would include if I'm managing Oracle, Sybase, DB2, Linux, etc. So I'll scroll down. Every object and every attribute is available to me to manage in the environment. I'll go into users. There's the object. I could actually recover my entire object with security ID information, or in this case, just the single attribute. Click the attribute, make the recovery request. And again, I'm going finding an attribute now in Active Directory. Where's the data stored right now? the backup copy? Same place, yeah, same place it was in the other two. It's stored on an Azure data center in the US. Find that attribute, recover it, do an authoritative restore, back into Active Directory, set the attribute back the way it was, and we're giving you, again, global application integrated management. Restore is complete. Come back to Active Directory. I have to refresh the screen, and I am no longer the Commvault Zamboni driver. So, data management. We can do this all day, Oracle, Sybase, et cetera. Where it really all comes together, and I said early on, is search. Now, the search capability, I'm going to do it at the enterprise level, but an individual user can actually search and manage their own data. So I'm going to log in as the administrator, very Bing-like interface. So I'm going to do an enterprise-wide search for the word Azure. When I do that enterprise-wide search, it's going to search SharePoint, Exchange, Windows, Unix, Linux data all throughout my enterprise. Online, nearline, archived, and deleted. Take a second. Now, I don't care as a user or an administrator if this data is located in Azure, Amazon, Windows, Unix, Linux. I'm using Azure Compute to do this kind of stuff. I'm using Windows Server to power it. So there's that Azure V4 document we were playing with around a SharePoint. As an administrator, I actually get an HTML rendered preview. I can see the document. Key from an administrative and a user perspective, I don't have to care where it's physically located anymore. I can search based on content. And this is where we're getting into. This is overall Windows and Azure-centric data management. So any questions on these pieces so far? All right, here's my e-discovery, long-term capabilities, lots of things I can do. If we had your HR legal teams here, we could really spend another hour or two on what you can do and when you get into advanced searches and queries and so forth. Lots of different ways to search and find your data. So usually at this point, I have one other guy with me, David I mentioned, and David likes to come up and do the last 15, 20 minutes because he'll actually hand me a walking cane or a hockey stick and say, all right, old guy, get off the stage because we're going to show some of the new feature ways of doing it. I'll take care. I'll try to do him justice here as we move on in that I'm going to go in and start up remote desktop connection. I'm going to connect. Log in. And as long as my internet's still up, I will connect to a virtual machine in an Azure data center in the US. I'm going to fire up Commvault. All right. Just log in properly. Now, the demonstrations, live demos I did before, were on on-prem, managing data on-prem, managing data maybe that's Azure Compute data, but using Azure as a tiered store. What I'm showing now, and again, we have a Commvault MSP in the room. If you guys haven't seen this, you just got a whole new business sector to talk to folks about. All right, we're actually running Azure and running Commvault and all those features we had before directly out of Azure. So I'll open up all the clients and showing a little bit more of an extensive environment. I'm managing about 50 different VMs, 50 different environments. And you take a look at the bottom, all right? And again, this is the beauty of where Microsoft's positioning Azure. I'm managing, you see that bottom machine, Lightning? That's an on-prem server in the US. You see the one with the penguin, Dingo Ubuntu. This is Commvault with Windows Azure managing Linux. All right, so here's my way to manage heterogeneous data management, but everything here from a processing and compute perspective is running directly out of Azure. So just do a couple, through a couple of machines here. Let's go to Active Directory. All right, I'll do a browse. And same exact screens. I don't have to do anything different. Loading the data, domain controller. There's actually a different machine. So all the objects and attributes are available to manage in this manner, directly out of Azure. I'll shut this one down. Let's take a look at that. You know, nobody from Microsoft's going to get mad at me. I'm actually going to browse. You know, Microsoft did some talking about running Linux directly out of Azure. Well, here I'm going to browse the data from the Linux perspective, from a Linux VM in here, and do what I have to, and browse how I would like to browse. So I have access to all that data. One other one we'll show is Exchange. Show something very similar. Exchange 2013, database level or mailbox level. I will browse. When do I want to see the data? A week ago, a month ago, a year ago. And now all those same mailboxes are available to me to manage. All right. So key here is I can use the compute power that I have on-prem. I can run the entire comp server media agent, our entire engine, directly out of Azure as I'm doing here, or I can do complete hybrid, mixed mode. Comp server, one location, maybe some media agents on-prem, maybe some media agents in the cloud. Questions so far? What? Yeah. Okay, question was, when you're managing SQL and you have to recover, can you recover online? Answer is yes. We have the file and group level. When you're talking about SQL, I'll generally get into an almost religious war. All right, and from that I mean, the SQL DBAs, they love the VDI interface. They love striping, pushing as much data as they possibly can out of those machines. We support that interface. The infrastructure guys love snapshots, VSS kind of capability. We support that. So I'll remain agnostic to how you want to recover or back up and let the individual DBAs or the infrastructure guys recover as they need to. But a full SQL restore would restore online, and when the SQL is complete, the SQL database will be up and running. At the file and group level, you can do some of the granularity. Mm-hmm. Question? Correct.
Do you have to pay for the traffic that is flowing from your Azure servers to the Azure storage?
Okay, there would be, so instead of the cost of the on-prem servers and so forth, Windows Server licenses, I kind of view that as if you're running.
You have all your servers in Azure?
Yes. Azure to Azure? Okay. You would pay for the additional storage you have in Azure, but no additional cost. No, no. If you wanted to restore that data back from Azure to Azure, that'd be the outbound price. Or if you wanted to restore that data back on-prem, that'd be the outbound price. But the data movement is staying within the data center. Yeah, yeah. So again, you guys are Commvault resellers, so you're kind of getting the there's opportunities here because folks are putting data in Azure. They have to. That has just as much e-discovery requirements and data management requirements as the data on-prem. So very, very savvy question. Yep. Other questions? All right. Continue presentation in remaining on time. All right, so let me close out of my remote desktop connection, come back to a true on-prem scenario, and go back. All right, so Commvault Azure Solutions, where I see the top four or five use cases, and we've gotten back from the existing customers. Modern data management, just like I just showed. Being able to manage your entire enterprise, single product, one copy of the data being stored, deduplicated, that's number one far and away. Number two, tape augmentation or tape replacement. People can finally get out of that tape rotation game, spending money on tape, shipping them off-site and managing them. E-discovery and search, well, I've shown you that, all right? So that seems to be a big use case. Use some of that Azure compute cycles for your e-discovery and search capabilities. Multi-location enterprise, that VMware to Hyper-V, intelligent provisioning of VMs, another critical component. I highlighted for the existing Commvault customers the ER file location. This one's kind of cool, and I wish I thought of it, but I didn't. It was our customers who did. I live in New York, and we had Hurricane Sandy come through a couple years ago. And literally, I live in Staten Island, which is an outer borough. but literally downtown Manhattan was offline. You couldn't get to it for 3 weeks. It was just shut down. What was going on is some of our customers actually took that emergency recovery file that we have out of the CompServ. They took, and guess where they moved it to? They actually store it in Azure. They don't send it to a file share someplace else. They just put it in Azure. By the way, since it's in Azure, they can spin up a CompServ up there real quickly and continue to run. So being able to use the ER file location for emergency uses is a great use case for Azure. We've spoken about the media agent running directly in Azure, which you've seen. And I mentioned geo-replication. We've had support with it, Microsoft, since day one. And the first Commvault customer that's been using Azure, Mike mentioned we have a lot of experience with it. The first customer we had was a shipping company in Alaska called Afognak, and they've been using it in production since 2008. So you're going on 7 to 8 years worth of burn time live production with Commvault. And actually, that was back before it was called Azure, when it was only called Microsoft Cloud Services. Another trivia question. So these environments we see today, you know, foundation for self-service IT. There are folks out there, Hyper-V, VMware, you got some Azure, maybe even have some Amazon. Question then becomes, how do I manage all that? I got Amazon tools, I got VMware tools, I got Hyper-V, crazy, all right? That's what leads to, you know, different methods. I showed you that chart before of all the different products. Very simple now, spin up a Commvault server in Azure, and you now have simple policies to manage all of that data on-prem and living in the cloud. Much simpler way to do it. And Azure's kind of enabled us to do that, manage everything much more easily. All right. You choose what you want to back up. You choose what you want to archive, selective location. So, yeah, this is kind of cool. We went through that exercise of moving data from Nervonix to Azure because Nervonix went out of business. So folks can actually take advantage of, if you have stuff in Amazon, we can move it there. If you have those VMware servers, move the data into Azure, we can actually provision, spin it up as a Hyper-V location. All right. So some of the best practices we've seen, WAN's the key. All right, you'll talk to your Microsoft rep. If you have a lot of data and need more bandwidth, you have something called Express Route for that higher speed bandwidth between your location and the Microsoft Azure data center. VM sizing, that's when you want to talk to Commvault. All right, we've got a lot of experience on how to provision those VMs and what sizes they should be. Take advantage of it, all right, because some places network throughput may be capped. This is where we have that expertise to add a lot of value. Blob storage versus Azure disks. Azure disks are awesome. Using blob is cool. All right, there's speeds, there's ways to take advantage of both, and we've kind of optimized Simpana to do that. Oftentimes, you know, you got those 1, 2, 3 terabyte SQL databases. Keeping that first copy close is important, or organizing your data management scheme to take advantage of what you have. All right, this is kind of what customers are doing today. This is a typical environment we're seeing. All right, I have my on-premises data center. And what they want is they want a single solution to manage everything. All right, you want it seamless, you want it unified, and you want something that manages, you know, not just Microsoft, but Unix, Linux, NetWare, DB2, Oracle, et cetera. All right, so the first mover of the data generally today is data center on-prem to make a local copy. So keep your high-end spinning disks and SANs here. Your secondary lower-cost disk that you still have around, use that for your primary copy. You have it there. It makes a great alternative. Commvault then, by the way, we only charge you for that first copy of movement of data. You want to move it to a secondary, tertiary copy, no additional cost. Then move it up to Azure, put it up into blob storage. All right. You may have Azure compute cycles. You might have Linux up there. You might have Oracle. You might have SQL running up there. All right. You might have SharePoint IIS running up there. Back that data up. Manage it appropriately. Index it. All right. Put it, you know, Microsoft will geo-replicate it if you like, having multiple copies in case something goes, you know, there's a geography issue, all right? You then have the ability to recover that data back down on-prem or maybe put it in a secondary location in another remote office. But the fact you have it up in a single location like Azure, I don't have to call up Iron Mountain to load tapes or send tapes back. I have it in a very easy stored location to recover, manage my data as I need to manage it, all right? We usually get into now the final set where actually I kind of stole David's thunder where I went and actually showed the live demonstrations in Azure. So with that, questions for myself, questions for Mike as we wrap up. Question, corner.
When's the WAN connection broken?
Good question. What if the WAN connection is broken?
I'm recovering. I have no local storage.
Mm-hmm.
I have only Azure.
Okay.
Okay.
Good question. Our legacy actually technically goes back to the phone system at AT&T. All right. And one of the things we put in the product very, very early. Again,
Randy,
I've been here 21 years.
Randy, can you just repeat the question?
Question was, what happens if there's an interruption during your backup or your restore? What happens if the Azure link goes away? What happens if my on-prem Ethernet goes away? All right, because that's a big problem with Symantec, and that's a big problem with EMC scenarios. No question, it is. All right, we built in what I call resumability over a decade ago. So if the backup has started, we'll talk backups first, then I'll get into restores. If the backup has started and the link goes away, we do have a checksum. We will actually continue that and pick up at the point of interruption when the network or the server target comes back online. All right? And people want to say, I want to see that. Well, we'll set up a demonstration at your location. Cobb will come in. We'll show it to you. All right? That also works for recovery or recalls and archive situations where if I'm actually restoring data and the primary network link goes away, we will try to reroute and so forth. The only time we would not continue the backup at the point of interruption is if another scheduled incremental or differential or backup was scheduled to occur after that. So if I was hung up on Monday night, it came in Tuesday morning, another backup was supposed to start, we'll start a new backup then. So we do have resumability built into the product, and that's an excellent question. All right. One other thing I do want to show very quickly, especially for the existing Commvault folks in the room. How hard is it to add Azure as a storage target within Commvault? Right, people ask that all the time. I want to see it. How is it? All right. So you would click on the storage tab within Commvault, and I want a library and drive management. And here's the server I'm working on. So I'm in my basically media control panel for the folks new to Commvault, and I want to add, here's click one. I want to add a cloud storage library. And just for argument, I'm going to call it Azure at TechEd EMEA. All right, click two is it is a new device. I simply go here and say, so as soon as you go talk to Mike Opel from Microsoft and get your Azure credentials, which I think you guys give away a month for free and so forth, so Commvault's now in the Azure marketplace. You can actually get a VM up there and start playing with it. You get your Azure credentials from Michael. Once you get those, you can immediately begin using Azure as a tiered storage location with Commvault. All right, a very, very simplistic way. It's about as easy as putting on another disk. Actually, in some cases, easier. Just get the credentials from Azure, and we're good to go. So one other thing I wanted to show. That is how easy it is to add Azure as a tier within Commvault. And you can do your aux copies, your secondary copies, tertiary copies. Other questions? All right, I'm going to ask Susanna to come up here. I'm going to ask Michael to come back up here. Because in the spirit of fairness, we're going to ask a question. How many folks, by raise of hands, how many folks want Michael to pick the winning ticket? You got some fans. I'm impressed. How many people want Susanna to pick the winning ticket? Michael, you lose. So Susanna from Commvault here in Spain, who lives in Madrid, is actually going to select the winning ticket. What? Question? What's that? Dim the screen? Okay. Oh, hold on. We'll get it. I got it.
Okay.
Let me go back over to the PowerPoint. That better? Okay. I think they really want to see Susanna, though. Okay. So Susanna will pick the winning ticket and go from there. So select one.
Oh, one.
Whoop. Is that the one? That's the one. Came out. Okay. There you go.